You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome, everybody, and happy Thursday. We're almost to Friday. Goodness. Welcome, welcome. I'm Maggie Dawn, your host for this, The Maggie Dawn Show, here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're going to start out with local and state news. We've got Dan Schaefer for the State Slate going to join me in just a moment. And then I'll be joined before the bottom of the hour by Jeremy Janine, the creator and contributor at Urban Milwaukee for Milwaukee as Microcosm. And then at the top of the 5 o'clock hour, we'll be joined by Mark Sommerhauser of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, keeping it all about the state and local government and politics this afternoon. We're going to be talking about Wisconsin imports and exports. This drives our economy on both sides of the scale. So what is this latest set of tariffs going to do to all that? We're in a tariff environment, the most tariffs we've seen on aggregate in decades in this country. What is that doing to Wisconsin's economy? We're going to break that down with Mark at 5 o'clock. And excuse me, that's at the bottom of this hour, 4:30. I'm losing track of my times. And at the top of the 5 o'clock hour, I'm super excited to be joined by Republican representative from our state assembly, Duke Tucker. He represents the 75th Assembly District. We're going to be talking about, I think, a critically important piece of legislation that Representative Tucker has introduced to have term limits here in Wisconsin. I am all about them. I think this is a critical democratic reform, and I mean small d democracy. Can't wait to talk to the representative about that. And then finally at 5:30 this afternoon, it's been a while since we've had an opportunity to sound off together. So it is going to be the opportunity for both you and I to sound off about all of these things that have been in the news, including some breaking news over the last couple of days. Apparently, Florida's got a concentration camp. The University of Wisconsin-Madison doesn't believe in equity anymore. And myriad other things like blaming Canada. We'll get there all this show, so you're going to want to keep it locked all afternoon. With that as introduction, let me bring on Civic Media's political editor and creator of the Recombobulation, Dan Schaefer. Hey, welcome back to the show, Dan. Lovely to see you, and happy belated 4th of July to you, sir.
Happy belated 4th to you as well. Always wonderful to join you here on the Maggie Dawn Show. Great to be here with you this afternoon.
We're happy to have you. So we finally have a biennial budget in hand, and it's been, I would say, a little bit controversial, both for Republicans and Democrats. Wanted to get your take on how we ended up in this spot and your view overall on the state's budget, especially how this came about, frankly, with Dems coming to the table at the last seconds, as I guess Republicans figured out they might not quite have enough votes after we have these fairer maps here in our state legislative districts.
Yeah, I think the big high level takeaway from this budget is that I think, you know, this is the first budget in more than a decade that has needed Democratic votes in order for it to pass. You know, most Democrats still voted against it. The agreement that was announced last week, Tuesday, by Governor Tony Evers and legislative Republicans, and along with state Senate Democrats. And I think that was really the difference between this budget and all of the others signed in this era of divided government with a Democratic governor and a Republican-controlled legislature. So the Republican-controlled legislature in the Senate, they did not have the votes to pass this budget with only Republican votes. So late in the process, at the 11th hour, they invited State Senate Democratic Minority Leader Dianne Hesselbein, who I know was on the show earlier this week, talking to you, Maggie. But bringing her to the table seems to be a really significant development in that, and I think was one of the main reasons that they were able to get a number of the bipartisan wins that they were able to achieve in this budget. So I think, you know, the special ed reimbursement rate, I know the state Senate Dems played a role in bumping that number up a little bit higher, and I think for the UW system, or the Universities of Wisconsin, I guess we're calling it now, it also paid for a number of capital projects. And I think that became a little bit more palatable to the Republicans in this negotiation because it was not ongoing spending. It was one-time spending. I know there was a project at UW-La Crosse that got funded. The Polk Library at my alma mater at UW-Oshkosh is going to get a big influx of funding to redevelop that. So I think that was, you know, so the governor touted a bunch of wins on childcare, on the UW system, and on K-12 education, particularly with that special ed reimbursement rate. And I think a lot of those wins, you know, were able to be achieved because for the first time in forever, because of the new fairer maps, we had state Senate Democrats at the table negotiating in this one as well.
Here's my question to you. You use the word bipartisan. I'll just be very transparent here. I don't really think it's bipartisan because while, of course, you had to have both Republicans and Democrats vote for it. So in that pure sense, based on the votes, bipartisan. But as you just pointed out, Dan, I'm going to say that these achievements for the universities of Wisconsin across the system, especially these capital improvements, the increase in the special education reimbursement rate, as well as a massive influx of dollars to help working families afford childcare in this state, that's only because Democrats were at the table. We wouldn't have seen those things without fairer maps and Democrats at the table. So I'm going to say that those are Democratic accomplishments that were brought about, frankly, by the voters. And because we have fairer maps that better represent the diversity of opinions and interests that we see across the state. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, we had in the previous, under the previous maps, they had a Republican supermajority in the state Senate. With the new fairer maps, the margin went from a 2/3 supermajority to an 18-15 split in the state Senate, 18 Republicans to 15 Democrats. And so Republicans could only lose one vote. And State Senator Steve Nass, who I don't think has ever voted in favor of a budget, he's just kind of a cut spending hardliner. And so they lost his vote and they could only lose one more. They ended up losing four Republicans in those negotiations. And so certainly some infighting among Senate Republicans on that as well, that you could kind of see from the speeches that were delivered in the final, you know, floor session on the budget. But, you know, the governor was negotiating. Voss was negotiating. Voss was talking about making an $87 million cut to the UW system, talking about, you know, not really doing a whole lot on childcare. You know, I think there was some movement with that special ed reimbursement rate, but I don't think it was quite as high as it was until Senate Democrats came to the table. So I think, you know, yes, a compromise budget. The governor is out there, you know, kind of celebrating that aspect of it in some media appearances over the week. But I think and what I put in my opinion column on this last week is that, you know, I think there was a lot of wins. A lot of those wins came from the state Senate Democrats being at the table. But I think there are still a lot of people wondering if this was enough, if there was, given that newfound leverage, that leverage was there for the first time in more than a decade with needing Democratic votes. Did Evers and the rest of the folks negotiating here get enough? And I think that's a fair question that people are asking.
Well, and I think that one of the things that I haven't heard discussed widely was the time sensitivity of the budget, both as to Medicaid funding, but also as to childcare funding. Those monies, that support through childcare accounts, ran out on June 30th. So this was not we have leverage and our leverage is increased the longer we wait. Leverage is only good depending on how long you can actually exercise that. And I think Republicans had a slight edge in terms of the timing here. Of course, we've had Derek Van Orten taking credit for that additional Medicaid funding, which is both ludicrous, stupid, two-faced, and a whole bunch of other words that I can't say on the radio about Mr. Van Orten. But again, I think there was a timing element here. Last week, we had Senator LaTanya Johnson on the show. I leveled what I thought were some questions about the Democrats that had been very specific, very pointed in their criticism. And my thinking has always been in this regard. It's easy when you're in a royal blue district, right? It's easy to, just like for Republican Representative Nass, to just take that hard line. It's easy to take hard lines when you have very consolidated support within your legislative districts. When you're not in those rooms, boy, that's a lot more difficult. And when you have things like, again, the childcare deadline looming and those trickle-down impacts, again, on the horizon, the timing, I think, had to be an element here, did it not?
Timing was definitely an element, and I think that's what I would think is kind of a frustrating element of this, too, is just that if Tony Evers and Assembly Republicans were it was the reality for weeks that Republicans did not have the votes in the state Senate, and they didn't, and they just kept going in circles and kept going in circles, and all of a sudden they're talking about this this Medicaid reimbursement funds that they might lose out on if the big brutal bill were to be passed before that. I question the urgency with which the governor and the legislative Republicans were approaching this, and the fact that it took until less than a week before the budget was signed to bring Senate Democrats to the table. I question the urgency of the governor's team and the legislative Republicans in wanting to get this done, both for the reasons that you mentioned, like the child care deadline and the big brutal bill deadline that was looming over it. It just didn't make sense to me why there was so little urgency for so much of the month of June to not try to get this done at a reasonable time. And then they were getting it done and the governor needed to sign it at 1:30 in the morning, and it's all of these different things, and it just seemed like the wrong
approach. Dan, that frankly Republicans weren't engaging in negotiations? They left the negotiating table, they threw their hands up. And I think what my read on some of the facts here, and listen, I agree with you that the governor should have been out there stumping in a much more direct way for his budget, and there's always something to criticize in compromise budgets, no mm-hmm. ifs, ands, or buts about that. But it's my impression that looking at Republicans, they just went, we're not going to talk with you. We're not going to negotiate with you. We're going to try to battle to get our own caucus in line and try to get it done that way. And it was only in that 11th hour and 59 minutes that they figured out, we're just never going to get those votes. Now we've got to negotiate. Such is the nature of many, 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 many budget debates that I've been involved in on the local level. It almost always seems like they're happening at the last minute. Moving forward, what do you think this looks like in terms of the power of Democrats within the state legislature, as well as the unity of the Democratic caucus?
Yeah, I think the Senate Democrats in particular are going to have a real possibility to flip the chamber in the next election. There are three districts in the state Senate that were won by Kamala Harris last year. We're already seeing some candidates start to line up to run for those. And so I think that is really going to change the dynamic in the legislature going forward.
And what happens if that dog actually catches that car? What will be on the Democrats' agenda come 2026? Big thanks to Dan Schaefer. It's the State Slate with Dan Schaefer, our political editor. Up next, we've got Jeremy Janine. We're going to talk about the city of Milwaukee's Vision Zero to have zero traffic deaths and how they're going to accomplish that. Stay tuned. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. The Bodines brings me back to my high school Summerfest days. We play the Bodines for this segment because it is Milwaukee as a microcosm for the state, and of course, Wisconsin as a microcosm for the country's politics. And we've got an interesting initiative that the city of Milwaukee has been working on for a bit. It's called Vision Zero, and that is to eliminate all traffic deaths within the city of Milwaukee. I particularly like this because it places the city in an affirmative policy posture. In other words, here's this place that we want to get to. Here is our goal. Instead of always being in this responsive, oh gosh, we have to stop the reckless driving, it sets out an ambitious, audacious goal for us to get to as a city. Again, not just trying to eliminate the harms, but trying to establish a positive direction. We've got Jeremy Janine of Urban Milwaukee, the founder and one of the journalists there. Welcome back to the show, Jeremy, and happy belated 4th of July. To you
as well. Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about Vision Zero. When did this come about? How are they going about trying to achieve this quite audacious goal?
Yeah, it sounds ridiculous on its face, but there's even one U.S. city that has achieved it. It's an idea from the 1990s that originated in Sweden, and it takes a holistic approach at eliminating traffic deaths. The acknowledgement that crashes are going to happen, but they don't have to be severe and they don't have to be fatal. And that includes not just people in vehicles, but pedestrians, bicyclists, everyone that could be around the road and using a road, that they should be safe. And the U.S. city that did achieve this is Hoboken, New Jersey, which is obviously a little bit of an outlier because it's a smaller city. It's only a couple square miles. Milwaukee is much larger, but they did it in a systematic fashion that Milwaukee is trying to do as well. And traditionally, when you think of increasing road safety, you think of three things: engineering, enforcement, and education. So enforcement, something we can all identify, putting more police officers out there or targeting certain reckless driving, that kind of thing. Engineering, the way Milwaukee is rebuilding streets. And there's a reason to think engineering could have big results. And one of the stats when the city put together its Vision Zero plan is 59% of serious crashes, so more than half of them, occur on 9% of the city's streets. So you don't need to re-engineer every street. And then the last thing, education, doing things like just raising awareness in high school of proper practices and even doing the logical, simple thing like teaching driver's ed to as many people as possible. So doing all those things in concert and then tracking your progress. Unfortunately, since I published this article, Milwaukee has recorded 2 more traffic deaths. It's now up to 23 on the year. So a long way to go, but it is down 7% from last year.
That is good news, bad news. And this is quite a challenge for a city like Milwaukee, but this is also one of those, again, holistic public policy approaches, trying to take a targeted approach using data and this kind of analysis to identify, hey, these are our tier one areas where we see the most fatalities. We don't have to do the same thing in all places because it won't have equal impact. This is the kind of thing that as a number cruncher, as a data wonk myself, I wish we saw more of this from policymakers. What has the public's reaction to this been so far? What are some of these improvements to the streets, these high risk, high fatality streets that the city has been making?
There's a lot of different things happening. You saw some really quick fixes. If you go down Capitol Drive in Milwaukee, you can see these curb bump outs that just prevent the most reckless passing in the parking lane. But also every time the city reconstructs the street, it redesigns it now in a safer way. So not only are you eliminating potholes, but you're just right-sizing lanes. We have a lot of streets in the city of Milwaukee, and you can see these across Wisconsin, that are way wider than they need to be. We had more people driving not on the interstates in the 1960s than we do today. So yes, a lot of opportunity to redesign streets. The city of Milwaukee also has a traffic safety unit within the Milwaukee Police Department, so focused on targeted offenses. And then there's advocacy at the state level, and we've talked about this in the past, on being able to impound the vehicles of reckless drivers. What's the reception to that? People favor some components of it. They're a bit more concerned with, I can't drive as fast as I want. But the key thing to know is speed can kill.
This is the trick here, and it's interesting to me. I'm going to draw a very, very rough analogy. When people say they want bipartisanship and compromise and then complain when they get it, well, I want safer streets and people to slow down, but wait, I can't zip by in the parking lane, and when I'm going to work, boy, I don't like that. Folks, you have to be able, again, these are collective, we're creating community goods by these kinds of programs and policy changes. And yeah, it's going to require behavior modification for all of us, right? Like, that's part of what this process is, and thinking, hey, I might need to leave a little bit earlier. And I'll just say this. I was an incredibly responsible kid, got really good grades, did all the sports, but I was an incredibly irresponsible driver. I drove way too fast. I got 2 speeding tickets inside of a month, when I was graduating from high school, my parents were super pleased with that. I was painting houses that summer to pay for that, and the insurance increases, believe you me. Listen, thanks so much, Jeremy. It's always a pleasure to have you. That's Jeremy Janine, the founder and creator of Urban Milwaukee, an online newspaper. Check out their work. Thanks for being here, Jeremy, from Milwaukee as a microcosm for Wisconsin. When we come back, we're going to go back to the statewide view. We'll be joined by Mark Sommerhauser of the Wisconsin Policy Forum to talk about Wisconsin's imports and exports and the impact of Donald Trump's tariff terrors on our economy here in Wisconsin. Keep it locked. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Days like today are why Wisconsin is heaven like a place on earth, or whatever the line is, which I just botched terribly. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. And happy Friday Eve, one and all. We resume our coverage of what's going on here in the state of Wisconsin by bringing on one of our favorite guests. His name's Mark Sommerhauser. He is with the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Welcome back to the show, Mark, and happy belated 4th of July to you.
Same to you, Maggie. It's good to be back with you.
This is just the kind of Wisconsin Policy Forum analysis that gets my blood pumping. It's one of these things, looking at our export and imports and what percentage of GDP this is, the trends over the last 10 plus years, and understanding that as we take a look at Donald Trump's tariff policies and what this might mean in Wisconsin is probably more important now than it has been. Certainly, we understand that a lot of trade took a massive hit during the COVID epidemic, right? And so looking at where we are now and the impact of these tariffs on Wisconsin's GDP and on our export and import trade is super important. You folks have published two reports, one on exports, one on imports, and the Wisconsin Policy Forum will be convening their virtual Friday forum event this Friday, right, Mark, to talk about both of these reports. So if you want to get more on that, go to WPF.org and sign up RSVP for their Friday forum. But let's start with the export side, Mark.
Sure.
Give us the broad strokes of what does Wisconsin export? How much of our GDP do exports account for? And these big picture ideas about exports.
Yeah. So we can start with some of those big picture ideas. I think one of the first big picture things to understand is that exports play a critical role in Wisconsin's economy to a greater extent than a lot of other states. That's in part because of our industry mix here in Wisconsin. We know that Wisconsin, our economy relies more heavily than a lot of other states on two pillars, right? Manufacturing and agriculture. And those are both export dependent, you know, industry sectors where a lot of the things that we make or we grow in those sectors, we export to markets outside the United States. And since about the mid-20-teens, the value of the total combined value of the exports that we're sending outside of the state of Wisconsin to global markets has fallen, okay? Since about 2012, 2013, when it peaked right around in that period.
Mm-hmm.
You'd asked about kind of share of GDP and total value. So in 2024, the total value of all exported goods from the state of Wisconsin was about $27.5 billion. So that was roughly just a hair under 8% of the state's GDP. The peak that we saw with that was back in 2012. It was down about $4.2 billion. So it was around in the neighborhood of about $32 billion in inflation-adjusted dollars back in 2012. And we saw kind of a trend here where export values actually grew quite a bit during the period from 2009 to 2012 during the Great Recession. Remember, these are exports, so these are obviously goods that are going outside of the country. We kind of hit that peak in 2012. We saw a drop, of course, during the COVID-19 pandemic, a little bit of a recovery in 2022, but then a little bit of a decline again in 2023 and 2024, which is kind of interesting. That was a time when we were seeing some growth in the national economy. So it's kind of interesting that the value of our state's exports were declining in inflation-adjusted dollars during those last couple of years.
So manufacturing exports and agricultural product exports dominate the Wisconsin economy, key engine here. What's leading to the decrease in exports? And does that indicate some sort of economic slowdown here in the state of Wisconsin? What does this mean and what's causing it?
Yeah, I think it's a little too soon to say that it means a slowdown. I think we're all familiar with the fact that our state's manufacturing sector has had some bumps in the road, and that's a story going back several decades, right? So it's certainly possible that it could reflect, some changes in our state's manufacturing sector. As we know that sector, while it's still very important to our state's economy, does not comprise as large of a share of our total economy as it once did, due to the effects of automation and a lot of things that I think a lot of folks are familiar with. Our report is not able to get too deep into some of the causation here. This is one of our shorter focus reports, and so we really just kind of lay out some of these high level data points. But what I would say is, with a lot of these shorter reports that we do, it often will have a finding and we'll go, huh. And, other folks will read it and go, okay, that's interesting. And a lot of times it'll lead to more research. We've already actually done, as you referenced, sort of a second piece in this series where we decided let's take it a step further and look at imports, kind of the other side of the coin. I think the fact that the value of exports has been falling in Wisconsin is certainly something that bears further examination. One piece that I think is likely linked to the statewide decline is the fact that in our state's largest metro area, Metro Milwaukee, we have been seeing declining export values. And so I think for any state, when their largest metro area is seeing a decline in export value, there's a good chance that that's going to affect the total statewide value.
And to be clear, this is exports of goods. You're not including in this service exports, which are a little bit different to measure and track and certainly represent a different segment of the economy. I want to be sure folks understand what data we're talking about here.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, great. So again, just to summarize, Wisconsin exported goods were valued at just under $28 billion in 2024. This is just under about 8% of the state's GDP. And what we've seen is a general decrease in overall both proportion and absolute dollar value adjusted for inflation of exports since that peak in 2012-2013. I think what's important here for folks to take with them is, one, we've seen that decrease. So the question is, what's causing it? The reports by the Wisconsin Policy Forum aren't putting forward a cause. And secondly, that the Wisconsin Policy Forum has done this research, right, that these numbers are now available for people to observe and to then track as we move forward, right? We hopefully can then understand better over the course of Donald Trump's presidency what the impacts of some of this macroeconomic tariff policy is. Folks, if you're just joining us, I'm joined this half hour by Wisconsin Policy Forum's Mark Sommerhauser. Wisconsin Policy Forum joins the show pretty frequently to talk about some of the excellent work that they do. They've recently issued two reports on Wisconsin export and import economies. If you want to participate in their Friday Forum virtual discussion about that, where they present this data in more detail, you can go to WPF.org and RSVP for their virtual Friday Forum, which is coming up tomorrow on these very reports. Of course, you can find the reports there as well.
And just Mark, jump in, Maggie, please. real quick. That event is actually a week from tomorrow.
A week from tomorrow. Yeah, my apologies.
So folks have a little more time to register if they want. We'd love to have folks join us, though. It's totally free. You can just go to our website and register, and it's like a Zoom type webinar event, so you can participate from anywhere that you have a good internet connection. So yeah, a week from tomorrow is when that event is happening.
My apologies, Mark, and everybody out there. It'll be on July 18th. That's when they've got their Friday forum. Let's turn to the import side of things. Mark, give us the big picture view of Wisconsin's import economy.
Yeah, so Wisconsin...
Wait, before we do that, I forgot to ask a really important question about our exports. Yeah. Who do we export this stuff to?
I'm glad you asked.
My bad, Mark.
No worries. But I'm glad you asked, because I think that is so important. And, part of the reason we did this, we know that there's so much increased interest in kind of our global trade in light of all the developments that have been happening around tariffs and other things. And I think it's really essential to understand here in Wisconsin who our global trading partners are. I think these countries may not probably won't surprise your listeners, but there were some surprises in here for me. So in terms of our exports, where are we sending stuff, goods from Wisconsin to? Our number one importer of Wisconsin products was Canada at about $8.5 billion worth of products that Canada imported from Wisconsin. So far and away, our biggest biggest importer of our products. Next up on the list, European Union, actually, $4.5 billion. And then very, very close behind the EU is Mexico at $4.4 billion. China was actually number four on this list. So I know there's always a lot of interest in China as a global trading partner. They're actually not in the top three, but coming in at fourth. And if you take those top four trading markets, they are about two-thirds, roughly two-thirds of all of our exports go to one of those four places, right? So I think that's important to consider. Go ahead.
Yeah, you talk Canada, EU, Mexico, China, right? Like, and this has been, yes, Donald Trump is the 90 countries with the reciprocal tariffs, and we were supposed to have 90 deals. The bulk of the tariff policy has largely been focused in these regions. They have by far the biggest impact on the U.S. economy, as well as here in Wisconsin. Turns out also they are the four places that we import all of our stuff from, the vast majority of our stuff from, too. I know we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But when we look at that level of export, what are you hearing from manufacturing CEOs? Have you talked to folks that are running agricultural businesses? Are they having to adjust their prices? Are they seeing retaliatory tariffs? How is it, do you have any sense from doing this research? Have you talked to some CEOs about their view of the economy and the tariff policy?
So great question. I know there definitely have been some retaliatory tariffs imposed in other countries. It obviously has been challenging to kind of keep track of all the moving pieces there because all these tariffs keep getting imposed and then pause and then the rates get changed. So that's been difficult for everybody, I think, to follow along with. We have not talked specifically to manufacturer CEOs. However, I'm going to use this opportunity to shamelessly plug our Forum Friday event where we are going to be talking to Del Cuyenga, who's the president and CEO of MMAC. We're also going to be talking to Jackie Carter, who's the port director over at Port Milwaukee, our state's biggest port. And then also the Canadian consul in Chicago is going to be joining us. That consulate covers basically a portion of the Midwest, including Illinois and Wisconsin and some other states. And so we're going to be hearing some of those perspectives, I think, at our event. And I'm interested to hear what, you know, for instance, what Del Cuyenga says about our manufacturers, whether the imports coming into the Port of Milwaukee have been impacted potentially here in the last few months. So that's kind of part of why we're having the conversation, and hopefully also being able to tease out a little more of the why to explain some of the numbers that we have here in our reports.
Yeah, I know that Del Cuyenga formerly served in the Wisconsin legislature, now the executive director of the Metro Milwaukee Association of Commerce, colloquially known as the MMAC. He's posted that he's been hearing and on social media that he's been hearing a lot of concern just over the overarching uncertainty that is surrounding U.S. trade policy globally. We're going to continue this great conversation with Mark Sommerhauser of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We're going to dig into some of the data from their most recent report about Wisconsin's import economy and how this might be affecting you and your family's pocketbook when we return right here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. We're joined this half hour by Wisconsin Policy Forum's Mark Sommerhauser talking about Wisconsin's export and import economies here. We were just discussing the export side of the equation. Now let's turn to the import side of the equation. Mark, give us the big picture view here.
Yeah, big picture, Wisconsin consumers and businesses bought about $39 billion worth of imported goods in 2024. That total sort of top line number in inflation adjusted dollars has grown about 32% just since 2016. So just in the last 8 years, it's a pretty significant increase there. Some of the biggest sort of categories of imports by value are machinery, pharmaceuticals, and vehicles. Probably not surprising. Those are all nope. things, obviously, that people or businesses can spend a lot of money on. A lot of that machinery, I think, of course, being purchased by businesses. This one, we can get a little more to the trading partners here in a bit, because the trading partners on our imports was maybe the biggest surprise for me personally within both of these reports. When we had authored this report, some more of these tariffs were starting to come online. And so we really did kind of note in our report that, both the tariffs and the possibility of retaliation by our trading partners do certainly raise concerns, whether it's concerns about potential inflation in product availability of various imports and, possible unintended impacts to manufacturers or other businesses here within the state of Wisconsin. We've since that time seen, a fairly confusing sequence of pauses and changes to some of these tariffs that have made it a little difficult to keep track of what's going on. So we're still, I think, in a lot of ways in sort of a holding pattern now, a couple months actually after we released this report.
32% growth in imports is very significant. And here in Wisconsin, again, when I look at that growth number and the total overall absolute dollar value of nearly $40 billion of imported goods, and again, we'll get to the trading partners in a moment. Everyone in Wisconsin should know that as tariffs start to take effect, and now we are paused again, but we do have already higher tariff levels than we've seen in this country in aggregate and on average than we've seen in decades, this is going to have an effect on consumer prices. This isn't a question of if, it's more of a question of but when. So if you think about tariffs as a percentage increase in ultimately the sales price of some goods, and we've got some nearly $40 billion of goods coming in to the state, you do the math. Things are going to be more expensive. The question is, how is that going to domino affect our businesses here and our families' pocketbooks? Let's talk about some of those trading partners, because the list, I think, is fascinating. Mark, tell us more.
So, the names of these countries aren't going to surprise you, but some of the trajectory that we've seen with the value of some of these imports was really the one that kind of caught me off guard. So, in terms of where does Wisconsin import goods from? Okay, the number one country there is China. Probably will not surprise anybody. Canada and Mexico are 2 and 3. But this one really caught me off guard. So that when we look at inflation adjusted value of imports from China, those have fallen, and not by a small amount, by about 37% in just the last 6 years, from about 10. Again, these are all inflation adjusted dollars, so we can kind of compare them more apples to apples. So the peak was about 10.2 billion in imports in 2018. As of 2024, that number was down to 6.4 billion.
That's just imports
to Wisconsin from Wisconsin consumers and businesses from China. Correct. So that one really was very striking to me. We purchase a lot of different things. Our businesses and consumers buy a lot of things from China: machinery, electric appliances, electronic devices, of course, are some of the big categories there. But that just kind of the trajectory there, I think, is very striking, even before, some of the recent trade war developments that we have seen just in 2025 with China, because, of course, these numbers only go through 2024, through the end of the Biden administration. That's pretty striking.
I just wanted to point out this other statistic or other data point from your report, Mark, and that is, I know that you distinguished between countries within the EU. You also distinguish, of course, the UK, no longer a member of the EU. But if you take the UK and all EU countries together, That actually would be Wisconsin's largest import partner, with some over $7 billion of imports coming from those countries. Folks, again, the Wisconsin Policy Forum report here is terrific. It's interactive. You can click on the different countries of on their map. You can find these reports at WPF.org. Mark, when we look at these levels of imports, what do you think the next 6, 12, 18 months will hold for Wisconsin consumers?
Boy, if I knew the answer to that, that's a difficult one to say. I think what we're beginning to see, again, the Trump administration several months ago imposed a bunch of new tariffs, then kind of paused a lot of those tariffs to create sort of a timeline to have a negotiation with a lot of these different trading partners. I think every indication that we've seen indicates there's going to continue to be a lot of uncertainty. And we will see here just within the coming weeks whether we have a little more certainty in terms of what these tariff levels are going to look like.
Thanks so much to Mark Sommerhauser of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Sign up for their Friday forum on July 18th, discussing these two reports at WPF.org. And keep it locked. Next up, we've got GOP Representative Duke Tucker talking about his new legislation to institute term limits in Wisconsin. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.